Good morning, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. It's 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio. I like to say Persistence Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, and we air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we are talking to journalist and Professor Meredith Clark and Professor and Black Lives Charlottesville activist and organizer Lisa Wolfork. Clark is a journalist and assistant professor in the University of Virginia's Department of Media Studies. She writes and teaches at the intersections of race, media, and power. She focuses on Black digital culture, including Black Twitter, and her award-winning dissertation entitled To Tweet Our Own Cause brought her wide recognition when she was named one of the most influential African Americans in the country in 2015 by the news outlet Route 100. We'll talk with Meredith Clark today about race and media marginalization, and we're talking with Lisa Wolfork, associate professor at UVA's English Department and college faculty fellow. She's an organizer in Black Lives Matter Charlottesville and has been active in discussions about race in this community, speaking out against white supremacy. We'll discuss local controversies and national race history, Charlottesville's recent mural controversy, and DeAndre Harris's case, and the important difference between not being a racist and being anti-racist, and more. You can check out all our shows. There are podcasts on the station website, 947wpvc.org. And Nancy, are you there, my friend?
Ellen.
She laughs.
I'm totally here. I'm here. I'm glad you have your glasses on.
Yeah,
That's the most important. I can see from here that they're on, and they look absolutely stunning.
Thanks. It's like an inside joke, yeah.
We can't get the, what do you call those cameras? The drone camera for all to see from, anyway.
Well, it is Passover. It is Easter. We've got everything wrapped up into one, and I have to say,
it's a combo weekend, right? It's a combo. You get two.
Yeah.
This is just like Christmas and Hanukkah, except with flowers and, I don't know, matzah.
I would like to say Chag
Sameach. I'm scatting here.
Let me get my guttural in there. I want to say Chag Sameach to everyone, and Happy Easter.
I feel like you just complained about something.
I thought you were going to say drop the mic. Anyways, you know, well, go ahead.
It did occur to me that, though I'm not in these circles anymore, that, you know, has anyone ever drawn the parallel between hiding a matzah and hiding Easter eggs? You know, there's all those parallels from the 8 days of Hanukkah and...
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, and the day of Christmas. But I wonder if there's some marketing going on.
Yeah.
This is my word, of course. At this time of the year, I wonder if we could get some.
It's very astute of you, Rabbi.
Naturally, the Jews, of course, take the chocolate out of it. I mean, they have to suffer.
Have
to make it a somber hunt for some dry cracker.
Yeah, but
yeah.
But that is nothing on Good Friday. That's a pretty stark one. But there are a lot of parallels, actually.
Yes.
A lot of parallels. The cups of wine.
I did not know that.
Cup of redemption. Breaking the, you know, we break this bread. We break the matzah. But the thing is, Christianity and Judaism don't connect usually, which is why I like Passover so much, because it's kind of the intersection, you know, where one line of history kind of Judaism leaves off and Christianity starts at the Passover Last Supper, at the Passover Seder.
That's a good point. You're right. The Last Supper was a Seder. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Am I getting credit for this? Can I audit this intro?
It's disputed, but a lot of people still widely believe that, and I think there's something there.
Oh, are we stirring a controversy?
No, I hope so.
Is our Twitter feed going to light up on this now?
No.
I wish it would. Actually, we could use some lighting.
I know.
We haven't mentioned Ellen. We should mention we have a Twitter. We have Twitter. We've had
go ahead, mention it.
For a year.
Mention it.
AOS Radio, please send us your thoughts and your
prayers.
Parallels between Easter and Passover.
Yeah.
So obviously we're running out.
I wanted to mention Puerto Rico is still without, thousands of people are still without electricity.
Yeah.
And you can go to the GoFundMe account of Elizabeth Alvarez, who was on this show. She's been mounting a Herculean effort to help people single-handedly. GoFundMe, Puerto Rico, Seville. Also, just I wanted to say that I just read that, of course, the regime, Trump regime, wants to, they're expected to weaken greenhouse gas emissions and giving, you know, potentially just rolling back the industry standards across the globe. And so it just feels like we're at this, I know we've been at this place and in different ways we've been here before, but at a crossroads for humanity, because people are telling me, oh, well, the stock market is so great. And I've heard different reporting on this, that people, you know, that's the plus side of all this. But sure, you know, if you want to completely deregulate, pollute, discriminate, whatever it's going to take to make a profit, at what price to society and anyone who's not a millionaire, you know, what price to our, to, it's a moral issue, really. And I just wanted to bring Angela Davis into this just for a second, if I can. Because she was amazing. I saw her this week and she was talking about a lot of things, but she talked about capitalism. And she said that the economic consequences of capitalism are devastating and that racism and capitalism are systematically connected, and that efforts to destroy welfare, like we're seeing now with this Republican Congress, is an apparatus of state violence, just on and on, that capitalism itself comes from colonialism and that it excludes most of the planet. Those are just a few gems.
Yeah, it's a great, when used the way they're using it, it's a great way to, you know, stay in power and subvert democracy and exclude minorities and run the world. I mean, they get all the privileges and none of the taxes, you know. It's unbelievable what, well, it's not anymore, but it's depressing how they have no... There's no baseline for, oh, right, we share this planet with a zillion other people. We should remember that. They just choose not to at every turn. And what about the car thing as well? I mean, speaking of Pruitt, was that part of your reading? That they don't even care what's spitting out of a car anymore, and you know, if your kids get sick and have asthma, you know, we can't think that far ahead.
Well, they don't care. It's just, to me, it's just greed.
Yeah.
It's just greed. And also, she was talking about, she just said disarm the police, you know, and that will come into our discussion later when we talk more. But just to get to some events, because we're already we need to keep rolling. The Nine Pillars Hip Hop Cultural Festival is happening. We talked about that with Cullen Wade. Lots of stuff. April 4th, Sally's Kids: An Oral History of Seville Rap, moderated by A.D. Carson. And also the annual powwow is happening for Native American Celebration on April 7th here. Beverly Daniel Tatum is going to be here. On April 10th, you can go to the Curry School of Education website to sign up. It's free, but you do need to register. That's April 10th, 4 o'clock. She wrote, "Why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria?" There's a lot going on, but I want to get right to our program.
Yes,
yes. Our first guest is Meredith Clark. She is a journalist, assistant professor in the University of Virginia's Department of Media Studies. She writes and teaches at the intersection of race, media, and power. She focuses on black digital culture, including black Twitter. Her award-winning dissertation entitled "To Tweet Our Own Cause, A Mixed Method Study of the Online Phenomenon Black Twitter" landed her on the list of most influential African Americans in the country in 2015. That was by news outlet Route 100. Well, welcome to the program, Meredith.
Thank you for having me.
So you were a newspaper journalist before social media is what it was. And tell us about how you became focused on black digital culture and why that is important.
Sure. So the connection between my studies now on black digital culture and my work history, my work history influences what I study. Back in 2010, before I left to pursue my dissertation or my PhD at UNC Chapel Hill, I read this article posted on Slate about how black people use Twitter. And I was instantly intrigued by the headline itself, but also by the content of the article. And one of the things that bothered me was the focus on the funny hashtags, the joking hashtags. Twitter in 2010 was a totally different place. After dark, people were just having fun, having a good time. But I was kind of troubled that the author had chosen to focus on just the jokes and the quote-unquote overrepresentation of black users on Twitter, and that he'd only spoken to media elites. So even black folks can be media elites. People who are running their own shows, have their own programming, they understand media and how it works in different ways than people who are just using it every single day and aren't actually creating it themselves. And so I decided I wanted to look into this newer aspect of how black people were being framed in media, and specifically in digital media, and then how we were also using digital media to create outlets for ourselves, akin to the way the black press emerged as early back as 1827 with the publication of Freedom's Journal, but looking at this in this new frontier. So how are we using digital media to speak to audiences that were otherwise overlooked by mainstream media? And then how are we using it just to speak to ourselves, to represent our own realities?
And in the time since you've been, in the recent time since you've been studying black Twitter, how do you think the press, you know, the black press has emerged from there? Has it changed much since you kept your eye on it?
I do. So, interestingly, I make the stark distinction between black Twitter and the black press. I would not say that black Twitter is the black press. I think that it is an offshoot, a rhizome, if you will, of the black press. Because the press itself, when we talk about journalism, does abide by a certain set of rules, a certain set of ethical guidelines and practices. And Twitter is freewheeling, and I have identified that black Twitter is developing its own cultural values for news and information sharing, but they are not the same as the ones that have been adopted from mainstream media. So I do want to make that distinction first.
Well, how would you define what black Twitter is?
So I define black Twitter as a network of culturally linked communicators using the platform to talk about issues of concerns to black communities. I find that there are three levels of connection within black Twitter: personal communities, what I call thematic nodes, and what one of the participants in my research referred to as neighborhoods. So those are the topics that you come back to again and again. And then the meta network of black Twitter, which is what most media and most people are referring to when they talk about black Twitter. So something that causes an incendiary event, whether that happens online or offline. So online, someone says something egregious, or offline, the murder of Stephon Cook, for instance, bringing people together to talk about specific topics, to get the algorithms to trend and to get people to pay attention to black voices on the issue.
And how is that, speaking of Stephon Clark, how is that news being treated on mainstream media versus black Twitter?
Well, within mainstream media, we're seeing the same kind of framing that we have seen over the past few years since, 2013, 2014, when the agenda kind of shifted to the number of unarmed black citizens of this country who were being shot and killed by police, or injured or killed through white aggression. I always like to point out that Trayvon Martin was not killed by a police officer. He was killed by one of his father's neighbors. So some of the same typical framing, the pictures that you see of Stephon Clark that crop out his family, so you think of him as an individual and not a member of a community or a family. The information that's raised about his background and not contextually, but things that are mentioned in order to get people to think about him as being somewhat deviant. So that framing is still there. It's still as problematic as it has ever been. And black Twitter is continuing to do what it has done in past years, which is open up the frame so that you do see the pictures of Stephon Clark as a family man, as a parent, as a Muslim, as someone who belonged in the place where he was and had no business being shot to death for simply being in his grandparents' backyard.
Mm-hmm. Holding a phone, yeah. Is there, at the moment, is there a whole hashtag? Well, actually, let me ask you this way. One of the things I read about you is you do a lot of research, actually, on how people that write on Twitter get harassed because their handles get included mm-hmm. in stories. So I was just wondering, I know this, well, it may not take long, so the story is new enough, but is that also happening with the story? Are black people, black Twitter users getting harassed, threatened with comments that they put online?
I have not seen that as much lately. It of course happens every day, but I will tell you that I haven't seen it as much lately just because in my own self-care, in 2016, 2017, I stopped watching so closely the reaction that people had to black people advocating for themselves in online spaces, because it becomes emotionally taxing, it becomes very draining, it becomes discouraging. And in order to function in the physical spaces where I operate, I cannot take that in day in and day out.
Mm. That's an interesting point about self-care, yeah. So yeah. Can you tell us about your dissertation, To Tweet Our Own Cause?
Sure. So my dissertation, I actually came to kind of by accident. As I mentioned, that story in 2010, I essentially put it in a folder on my laptop, took it with me to Chapel Hill, and through two courses on ethnography, one by Carla Slocum, who has ties to UVA, and the other by Glenn Henson, who's in the anthropology department at UNC, I learned about ethnography and how to connect my existing skill set as a journalist to this more structured social science approach to studying communities and culture. And so it took a little bit of persuasion, but I was able to study Black Twitter for my dissertation. And so my main objectives were to do a couple of things that I hadn't seen done before. So this is the first dissertation written on Black Twitter. It came out immediately after two articles were posted on Black Twitter, but those were released literally 2 to 3 months before my dissertation was finished. So we were all working on this at the same time, although I didn't know at that time the other scholars working on the topic. My objectives were to identify what Black Twitter was and to do that in the voice of the individuals who participate in the phenomenon themselves. So often in research and in scholarship, we're taking these positions as academic elites and observing the terrain and doing cultural anthropology and describing for people what we see instead of allowing people to speak for themselves. So that was important to me. And then the second part of what I wanted to do was identify how Black Twitter worked. There was something about the discourse online that I saw was having an offline impact, and I could see that it was some sort of process, and my goal was really to nail that down. So I came up with essentially an outline, a six-step process of what I call being Black Twitter back then, identifying with the topics of discussion, self-selecting into the discussion, participating through the use of a strategic hashtag or phrase, affirming others in conversation, and then taking those conversations offline in a step that I call reaffirmation, and then finally finding vindication by either disrupting mainstream media narratives about Black life in America or finding vindication by achieving additional coverage about Black life in America. So, of course, this is framed from a mass communication perspective.
And what are some examples of offline impact that you see?
Well, the most salient one is obviously Black Lives Matter. As an online movement and an offline movement, I don't think that Black Lives Matter would have had the same impact had communities of practice not already been talking about racial injustice, police brutality, the surveillance of Black communities and communities of color. The reason that that hashtag was so effective in the online space was because it was culturally resonant. There were people who understood immediately what it means to say Black Lives Matter. And so then to have those people in place, to have things like Feminista Jones's National Moment of Silence in 2014, which was an online vigil that got people around the world and throughout the country, I think in 190 some odd cities in the country, to just take a moment to be silent at that time. The infrastructure was there for Black Lives Matter to become what it turned into, and that being a social movement. So that is one of the most salient cases that I point to.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Meredith Clark. We're talking about media marginalization, Black Twitter, Black digital culture. We'll be right back with Meredith and also Lisa Woolfork, associate professor at UVA's English department and member of Black Lives Matter Charlottesville. We will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Meredith Clark, journalist, assistant professor, UVA's Department of Media Studies. We've been talking about black culture and black Twitter, I should say, and black digital culture. Hey, Nance.
Meredith, I know we only briefly touched on journalists at the beginning of talking with you, but I was just wondering, what can online journalists do to better engage with Black America and other social media communities that are marginalized?
Mm. Well, I'll take that in two directions. So the first one is what anyone can do, right, to better engage with communities of color. All of the people who are, with the exception of Russian bots, all of the people who are online, all the accounts there are actual people. And because I do social media work, I am very aware of how my offline interactions function. And so I think about the everyday benign interactions, or seemingly benign interactions, that we have with people who are not like us. So I remind people to think about how they interact with people of color when they are in physical spaces. You know, do you engage people of color? Do you look them in the eyes and speak to them when you pass them on the street? Do you treat them like your equals? Do you, you know, talk to us like you would talk to anyone else? It's something that I find really interesting, especially living here in Charlottesville. I interact with people all the time, and they sometimes pretend I'm invisible. And so that's the first thing. So remembering what happens in the physical world is, by extension, what's happening in the online world. And then in online spaces, for journalists and just for people who are there and using platforms like Twitter and Facebook, I'm mindful that no one is there expressly to educate you, so that even though social media can be a great tool for learning about communities and cultures that you know little about, you do have to remember that asking people for information is asking them to provide labor. And if you're not compensating people either with time or money or something of value, just remember that you're asking them to take on a role for you. So I think some of the best ways to engage: follow people who are different from you, who have different views. Follow people whose communities you want to know more about. Listen to the things that they say. Retweet them, and it's possible to retweet things without adding your own editorial judgment to them. And share them. There are so many people who are not online, you know, your family members, people in the community spaces where you go, where they're aren't folks from other backgrounds and who have different perspectives. Take what you learn from those spaces and share it with the people who are not in those spaces.
So why did you choose Twitter as your medium and not Facebook or something else?
So it goes back to my work in journalism. When I was working at the newspaper in Tallahassee, Florida, I was the first in the editorial board suite to join Twitter, and my coworkers at the time, so I was a good 30 to 40 years younger than all of my coworkers. It's usually a job for people who have been in news for many years. I was the first one to join, and I did it because I wanted to bring people inside the endorsement process. I wanted to know you to know what those meetings were like. And so as I was there, it was just very interesting to me to watch people sign on in the morning to greet their timelines as though we were all standing in the same room. I saw the relationships that were forming, people were dating. And since Twitter is a broadcast medium and you have many people talking to many people all at the same time, it is an easy point of access for studying culture and for studying cultural discourse. And so that's why I chose it. It's the easy access and, frankly, the fun of Twitter.
But I'm sure that, I know that creating a black space is not enough in terms of dealing with this white, as you call it, the whiteness that is the default in America or the world. I don't know. Anyway, how do we get less, or how do we take the default out of it being white? How do we all participate in doing that?
I think it's important to ask questions about the assumptions that we make and the reality that we experience. So I point to Joe Fagan, the sociologist who has written extensively about whiteness as the default experience in the United States. As a source of information, I think reading his work is a great place to start because he talks about interrogating the white racial frame and seeing whiteness as an ethnic or racial identity. Reading works by people like Peggy McIntosh and talking about unpacking the invisible knapsack, those are great places to start. And then, you know, when you have some time, when you're riding in your car or you're waiting somewhere, thinking about the assumptions that you make based on the way the world is set up. What privileges do you have by being who you are, where you are? How might someone experience something in a way that is completely different from you based on their race, based on things that they have absolutely no control over? And then thinking about history. History shapes everything that we currently experience, everything from where people in our communities live to who has access to particular resources, to who is able to speak, to who is privileged. And if I can, I'll just add one quick example of that. One thing that I'm seeing a lot of on Twitter these days is this practice of actually naming people instead of allowing headlines to say a local teen wins big scholarship or wins a prize. I saw one today about a teenager, I believe, in Maryland who won the same prize that authors like Stephen King has. And the headline says, you know, Maryland teen wins this prize. One thing that people of color are doing now is breaking out of the tendency to revert back to these practices that we have in journalism, the delayed lead, so you use something that identifies a person you don't know instead of their name, and saying, no, say our names. Say who we are, tell people who we are. And that is that process of interrogating the white racial frame and whiteness as a default in practice.
So,
go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, what if you could just condense the main thing that you would want people to know who might be listening, some of, you know, what you've learned, and what would you want to communicate?
The main thing that I would want people to know, that none of what is happening in the social media age is happening in a vacuum. All of it has historical precedent, it has historical root, and just because we are now in a digital age does not mean that we weren't and aren't heavily influenced by what is analog. So the interactions that we see online are rooted in historical sources of power and sources of oppression, and it's important to make the connections between what we have experienced before and what we're experiencing now.
Do you think online journalists are becoming more objective, or is it on a flat line, at least at present?
So objectivity is one of those journalistic values that I challenge, and I challenge over and over again. The journalistic value of objectivity became valued back in an era where only white men were creating the rules of engagement in journalism. And so I ask questions, of course, you know, I'm not a positivist. what does it mean to be objective? Because you filter so-called facts through your world perspective, does it mean that you are being objective? You know, what's written in a police report is considered a fact, and simply reporting on it would be considered being objective. But over the last 4 to 5 years, we've seen that you have to ask questions about those things because sources of power and sources of authority can and will lie. So I really do challenge that notion. I would want online journalists to be more thorough, to be more empathetic, to be more knowledgeable of history, and to be more knowledgeable of intersectional examinations of power in what they report on and what they work on.
Thank you so much for being here, Meredith Clark, journalist, expert on Twitter, yeah. I would say, and Black digital culture. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank
you. Little E on the expert.
Yeah.
That was very enlightening. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope you can stick around, but
absolutely.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. So we have a news of note coming up right now, Nancy.
We do have a
I'm
news
so
of note.
Serious.
Would that be my news of note, or do you want to go first?
I'll start. So there's a surgeon at Vanderbilt University. I don't know if you've heard about this. He is one of seven Twitter users suing Trump. His case is, or the it's called Knight First Amendment Institute versus Trump. For being blocked from Trump's Twitter account, because of course it's not his personal Twitter account anymore. It's really policy. This guy's name is Dr. Eugene Gu. He's a surgery resident at Vanderbilt.
Oh yeah.
And he also took a picture of himself kneeling, and he said, "I take the knee to fight white supremacy." And he became a little bit famous, you may have heard of him, for doing so, because he really identified with the movement, with Colin Kaepernick, and he was physically attacked in a parking garage himself. That's why he identified with that. But for doing so, he was put on probation. He was on leave, really, and now he's on probation, which is really, really stinks.
Yeah, no, I did not know that part. I knew of him, but that is an incredible story. Well, mine ties into this horrible administration in that for the first time in 70 years, this administration is putting the citizenship question back on the 2020 census. 1950 seems to be their safe space, and their decision to ask people about their citizenship will raise concerns in all households, not in native and foreign-born citizen and non-citizen, and about the confidentiality of information provided to the government and how the government authorities, especially this government, will use that information. And the effect, of course, is going to be to dodge the survey altogether, diluting political representation in all states, you know, not just California and New York, not just the blue ones, but red states like Texas and Arizona. We're all going to be hurt by this pernicious question. It'll, you know, the undercount of immigrants and minorities will redraw districts inaccurately, affect the makeup of Congress, determine where the money's going to go to build schools and roads and health care facilities and child care facilities. You know, they're supposed to count everyone, as it says in the Constitution, not just the citizens, but, you know, far be it from them to pay attention to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So all under the guise of trying to protect the Voting Rights Act, which is the most indirect, crazy rationale, since they could care less about the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. It's just nonsense. Anyway.
So I would say vote, everybody. You know, I'm a little bit concerned that people think there's going to be a blue wave and that people will relax. It needs to be huge, because I was reading some things about the gerrymandering
yeah.
issue, and that if it is a blue tsunami and not just a wave, we can overcome that kind of redistricting. So just
yeah, you
vote.
Had it in your state. You had like 60% Democratic turnout for that, whatever it was, that election you had for governor,
mm-hmm.
right?
Northam. Mm-hmm.
And you barely split the House.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I think you didn't even split it with 60%. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Well, anyhow, so I wanted to introduce our next guest, Lisa Wolfork, Associate Professor at UVA's English Department and a college faculty fellow. She's a member of Black Lives Matter Charlottesville, has been very active in discussions about race in this community, speaking out against white supremacy. And I wanted to talk about local controversies with her in addition to race history on a national level. We're going to talk about the mural, many other things. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yes. So I have to admit, I've only been hearing recently about this phrase that I've said, and I want to say it again, and I want you to talk about it. Very intrigued by the important difference between not being a racist and then being anti-racist. Can you talk about that?
This is something that I think is an important distinction, non-racist versus anti-racist. And this is a distinction that many people have made. Professor Ibram Kendi has a book. It's called The History of White Supremacist Ideas in America. And he talks about this. But there's a wonderful short video clip that does as well. Non-racist is really means that I'm just not a racist, and as if this is sufficient. Anti-racist is a way to, I believe, move the country forward, to really allow America to fulfill all of its promises, that one would stand against and actively move toward creating a society that is more equitable, more equal, more fair, and stands against and helps to balance
the racism that has helped to shape the foundation from this nation from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And in addition, I know, Lisa, you've spoken about race history is not a white person's issue to correct. I mean, it's not just your burden; it's everyone's burden to remedy this.
Absolutely, I think it's important to allow for very challenging conversations for white people in particular, for us all to understand that white supremacist ideology is a pervasive ideology. It is something that shows up in a variety of ways, and that white supremacy and racism in particular can only be resolved with conversations, with work, with diligence and vigilance on the part of white people. The first step to that can be a difficult one because it requires a lot of discomfort, but I think it's worth it in order to produce the society that we believe as a nation that we say we want to have. And this is one of the challenges that I think is really useful. And this is something that in the moment that we are now in 2018, particularly in Charlottesville, where people are starting to talk more and more about racism, and we have an opportunity here to really help move the needle on this conversation and to have some real change. But it's not going to be easy. It's going to require people stepping outside of their comfort zone, particularly white people. And that's something that's going to absolutely have to happen in order for this to work.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Lisa Wolfork. We're going to come back and talk a lot more with Lisa. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC. This is Ellen Daniels. I'm here with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday, trying to bring you the best shows we possibly can with great guests like who we have here in our studio. We're talking with Lisa Wolfork, and we just spoke with Meredith Clark. The podcast is available on the station website, 947WPVC.org. So, Lisa, can you tell us about white supremacy? What that is, what that means to you when you talk about needing to combat that and fight that, and how you see it being played out on all levels.
Charlottesville has become a city that's almost a flashpoint for what white supremacy means. However, a lot of people that are thinking about white supremacy have a very narrow definition of what it is. It's easy, I believe, to recognize white supremacy when it's marching in the streets with Nazi flags, with Klan hoods, with shields and helmets, when it's pummeling people in parking garages. White supremacy is easy to see then. However, we are also heavily impacted by subtle and nuanced forms of white supremacy in all varieties of our lives. And I think that requires a very complex approach in order to really attack and to better understand how it shows up. So one small example that I recently learned of from a teacher at Western Albemarle High School concerns the 11th grade history SOL. If you're not familiar, the SOL is a standard of learning test that's given to public school students to test their general knowledge. So apparently there's a question on the test that asks, what was the cause of the Civil War? And the correct answer is states' rights.
That's the correct answer?
That's the correct answer. That's an example of how white supremacy shows up. When you neutralize and naturalize extreme ideas, when you think of the Confederacy not as a white supremacist republic founded on slavery, that the cause, as the people in the Articles of Confederation stated when they were creating the choice to defect from the Union, they wanted to preserve slavery, which was tied up in white supremacy. But instead, you say, well, this is simply a difference of opinion, you know, that I think that we have to work really hard to be as clear as we can to name things honestly and truthfully. So this notion that somehow white supremacy can simply be a difference of opinion. Some people are racist and some people are not. Some people are anti-Semitic and some people are not. Some people are Nazis and some people are not. These are not neutral concepts. These are violent ideologies that are directly linked to violence against marginalized people in the struggle to create a white ethnostate. This is not just pages in a book.
it is pages in a book, but it's more than that. And so I think that my concern as right now in 2018 is that too many folks, I believe, are resigned to accept white supremacy in its most extreme forms and condemn it. But they are not willing to condemn it in the neutral, nuanced, and subtle forms that show up in our courts, that show up in our streets, that show up in our classrooms, that show up in ways all throughout our community. And that's where people can get active. That's where people can start to make real changes and, you know, and press for real positive change.
In your view, is that how you, not you, how one can have that racist rally calling last year hate speech free speech, and therefore getting everyone to assemble to, you know, not even under the guise of those monuments, which they call monuments, but I know you have spoken and said that they're statues and this stuff, giving them so much regard, but nonetheless that the hate speech being, you know, actually free speech. As
that's excellent. What you've pointed to there is one of the prime examples of how fascists have used and compromised democratic institutions to advance their own causes. So in some ways, they've been able to kind of twist and use in really perverse ways some of our highest ideals, the Constitution, or in DeAndre Harris's case, our legal system. So as you might know, DeAndre Harris ended up, who was brutalized in the parking garage, ended up being charged for assault by one of the white supremacists who was on the scene. The white supremacists swore out a warrant, and then DeAndre was arrested and then had to go through all this trial. He was exonerated, as the judge said, quote, he did nothing wrong that day at all, and yet still had to go through this painful, traumatic, and public process. And that is a problematic concern, because what we see, and this is a trend that that Nazis and white supremacists have used all over the country. They invade a community. They come armed with cameras and with weapons. They lure people into violence and then strategically either press on footage or use what they have caused to basically transform victims into assailants. And I can say I was in the court that day for DeAndre's trial, and one of the most distressing things that I've seen was sitting there in the gallery as a community member and seeing the way that the plaintiffs and the defendants were arranged in front of the judge. This is Judge Downer's court, General District Court, right downtown. And so on the left, you had DeAndre and his attorney, and then the judge in the middle, and then on the right, you had a white supremacist who works with the League of the South in North Carolina, and standing next to him, defending him, advocating for him, was Joe Platania. It was one of the most distressing things I had seen, and I've seen a lot of distressing things. I voted for Platania, and I voted for Platania because I believed he would represent me, that he would represent this community. I never thought that he would stand there and represent a white supremacist in a case so egregious that it was quite shocking. It looked very much like he was literally and figuratively standing alongside a white supremacist to the damage and harm of a black Charlottesville resident who had been brutalized by white supremacy. It was mind-boggling, and it was so stark. And this is one of the reasons why many people have been urging Platania to drop the charges against these three black men who have been caught up and abused in this legal system in this way. Because of these optics, they're so damaging, they're so dangerous, and it really was a quite harrowing experience to be in court that day and to see Joe Platania in line with and on the side of someone as vile as Harold Cruz.
And tell people who he is.
Harold Cruz.
Platania first.
Platania, I'm sorry. Joe Platania is a Commonwealth's attorney, recently elected, and he represents, I thought, the people. But the people in this case seems to be a white supremacist from North Carolina.
Well, given his acquittal, Mr. Harris's acquittal, do you think, I'll ask you, do you think supremacists hold, you know, their hold on the justice system is weakened in a significant way, or do you think this is a one-off? What do you think?
This is a great, I think it's a great victory. It's a great decision. I also believe that it shouldn't have gone to court in the first place. I think that that would have been a better path. To have the charges dropped and to not have DeAndre be brutalized physically in a parking garage and then 500 yards later in the courtroom be subject to a certain type of judicial harm. I think that the better course would have been to drop the charges and to not pursue them. And yet, I am, of course, happy. This is a victory for our community. It's a victory for people who are committed to the work of anti-racism and a more just society. And yet the problem remains that Joe Platania, the Commonwealth's attorney, could easily be perceived to be in league with white supremacists.
I know you teach a course, called Making the Invisible Visible, about cultural artifacts like books and art. Can you talk about the mural in that context? What is going on in this town with this controversial mural?
This was a course that I taught with a colleague, Laura Goldblatt, this last semester as part of the College Fellows Program, which was a wonderful course, and we did a lot of work with local history. The mural that recently is being discussed, and you can find out more information about this on Solidarity Seville on Medium.com. There's a recent editorial that news agency, news service just recently put up. But Shepard Fairey, who is a well-known artist, he's most known, I believe, for a lot of guerrilla art, street art, and the famous Obama Hope poster, came into Charlottesville through the Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative, and wanted to do a mural. Alan Gafensky, who is the director of the project, said that Shepard wanted to give Charlottesville a bouquet of flowers. And the bouquet of flowers was going to be this mural. A lot of it was very hush-hush, and the public didn't get to see what the proposed mural would look like until it was revealed at a small BAR, a Board of Architectural Review meeting, on March 20th. And so when it was revealed, it's very problematic design. Heather Heyer featured in the center with four anonymous community members on either side. There's a lot of issues with hagiography, as well as centering whiteness and kind of flattening the resistance in the multiracial coalition. But I think something that's really useful about that is that what it shows to me is the importance of people speaking up. That I was there at that meeting, and I wanted to say I believe we do need a mural. A mural would be a beautiful tribute and a way to kind of help heal and not resolve, but heal the community and help move us forward. But it shouldn't be that mural, and that it should be something that's more broadly based and more community support, broader community buy-in. And something that I learned was that really important decisions happen at boring meetings. And so I wanted to just use this opportunity to urge people in our community today to show up, to stand up, to come out to things. Some folks might describe me as an activist. I never think of myself that way, really. I just think of myself as a mom, as someone who wants to have the world be a better place for her own children. So when her own children are the age that she is right now, they won't have to do this. My grandmother is 104 years old.
Wow.
And the idea that I would have to tell her that the Klan and Nazis were marching through the streets of this community is a horrifying thought. And the idea that 50 years from now, my kids are going to be dealing with the same thing. Whose fault is that? Mm-hmm. Whose responsibility is that? I think it is our responsibility to ensure that future generations do not have to do the same things that we have had to do. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to avoid that is to get active, go to community meetings, go to city council, go to the architecture review board. Think about how public housing is handled in this country. Ask yourself, why is it that Charlottesville has a black community of about 20%, about 20% of Charlottesville is made up of black people, and 70% of the stop and frisks, are black people. That is not an accident. That does not happen because the system is broken. That happens because the system is working.
Well said.
Sounds like a reason to have a hate rally in last year, actually.
I mean, like Angela Davis was saying, just disarm the police. You know, the UK does not have armed policemen, and things work out just fine over there. They have less gun violence. Well, thank you so much, Lisa. If there's any one last thing you want to say, I feel like you said so much so well, but I wanted to give you that opportunity if you wanted to. And the being active is amazing.
I just wanted to end on this note to get people to come out and to find out information for things about which they are interested. I highly recommend that people look up Solidarity Seaville on Medium. There's a weekly weekend review about things that have happened and things that are on their way to happening. You could also check Solid Seaville on Twitter. There's an organization showing up for racial justice on Facebook or Surge, S-U-R-J. There's lots of info there. Black Lives Matter Charlottesville also has a Facebook presence. But stand up, show up in your community, you know, go to meetings, be willing to be uncomfortable, be willing to shatter the illusion, as Nakia Walker has urged us to do. These are how things get changed. People change them. The history, if you ask yourself, people say, oh, if I lived back in the 1960s, I would have stood with Martin Luther King. I would have sat at a lunch counter. If you are not sitting at a lunch counter today, you would not have sat at a lunch counter 40 years ago. If you are not out there standing in front of courts waving signs, you would not have done the same thing 40 years ago. There are lots of ways to get active. Not everyone has to be out there in the streets, but everybody can do something. You don't have to do everything, but everybody can do something.
Right. Actually,
you are speaking my co-host language.
Yeah, we say that at the end of each show. No one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And I think we've lost the luxury of not being involved anymore, is what I feel like.
Yeah, that is a good point as well. All good points. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Wolfork and Meredith Clark, thanks for being here.
Yes.
Okay. Right. So just to completely go in a different direction.
It's neat.
It's time for the palate cleanser.
You know, I'd like to have that music on when Sarah Sanders takes the podium. It is such a good tune.
Or like a circus music. Or something
like that. It's as nonsensical as she is. Anyway, speaking of nonsense, what do you got? No, I'm kidding.
So
inside, am I going first?
In Siberia, where it's 40 degrees below zero, there's an abandoned diamond mine called Mirny. It's in, like I said, Siberia. In the 60s, it was producing like 10 million carats of diamonds per year. And right now, it is such a deep, it's a deep, deep vortex hole that it sucks helicopters right out of the sky.
What? From down? Get out of here.
It's true. Really? Look it up. There's a lot about it. And also, because in 1947, this became this big mine, that one of the distributors of diamonds coined the phrase, a diamond is forever. That it came because of those distributors in this mine. But the helicopter thing is the thing I thought was really kind of funny. Anyway, what do you have?
Well, mine is in space, curiously. So thank you. NASA from New Jersey. NASA's International Space Station, it's about the size of a football field. It's the third brightest object in the sky. You can see it from the ground, but it passes really quickly, so it helps to know where to look. But NASA has made that easy. It has solved the problem when they have an interactive map on spotthestation.nasa.gov, which allows you to enter your location, and it'll tell you the best places to view the space station as it passes overhead. And they even have a service where you can have them text you or email you when it's coming to a sky near you.
That is cool.
So what do you think of it? It is cool because, you know, we're all headed up there to get off this planet, so it's good to know where that thing is.
Yeah. So
space.
It's time to thank our theme music by Springtide. It has this very silly name, N3540 19800, speaking of space. And I will say what Lisa said again, as always. Well, first, democracy is not a spectator sport, which Tom Hartman always says. And no one has to do everything, but everyone does have to do something. Thank you for tuning in. And thank you, Nancy. Thank you, our guests.
Yeah.
Talk to you next week. See you, Nance.
I agree.
Okay.
Bye-bye.